Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The latest Trump drama. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews that they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Riverside, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How are you?
I'm good. I expect it to be much better because today is opening day, which is always one of my favorite days of the year. But I guess I should have known. The Mets are rained out.
Oh, yeah. That's the worst.
So, yeah, that's the worst. But that, you know, and then we have all this bad news, so it's hard to stay upbeat about it. But I always, there's some part of me that always, whenever they're finally back and when it's opening day, I'm like, all right, it's back. Thank God. And when I was a kid, my dad took us to opening day a couple of times, and it was just it was an unbelievable experience for a little kid. I was in the stands when Jerry Kuzman pitched his first home game for the Mets. I think it was 68, and he loaded the bases in the first inning, and then he struck out Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, and Jim Ray Hart. To leave the bases loaded. And my dad looked at me and said, you know, I think we may have a pitcher here. And we did. So
that's great. I haven't been to many opening days. I remember one, I don't know, 15 years ago now, but Yankees Rangers at the old Yankee Stadium, and it was a wet snow, you know, by the end of the game. Ugh. You know, it wasn't sticking, but it was miserable, and I still had an ethic then. I would stay to the end of every game, no matter what. I gave up on that long ago.
But that doesn't mix with having kids, but yeah. You're right.
Yeah, so the Mets are projected to be third or so in their division. Is that
You know, I like the J.D. Martinez thing. It's a good pickup. And you know, look, they were oversold last year, and you know, maybe they'll be underrated this year. We'll just have to see. Yeah. You know, it's the pitching. You have to worry about the pitching, but yeah. We'll see.
Well, no.
Sorry, Megan. Sorry.
3 months or so. Okay. All right. So Joe Lieberman passed away suddenly after a fall, but a great man.
Yeah, he really was. I got to know him a little bit when I was doing national security stuff toward the end of my career. And then when I got out of the Justice Department and started doing this stuff, he reached out to me because we had all these, you know, how do we deal with terrorism debates going on? And everybody knew it wasn't a crime, but it wasn't quite it didn't present as a normal war. And how should we deal with people who we capture? How should we deal with the Fourth Amendment tension with trying to keep a big city safe? That, you know, all those kinds of issues that were very big at the time. And I really liked him a lot because he was somebody who you could talk to about that stuff without, without the ideological baggage that was already starting to pile up on each side. Mm-hmm. He really was one of these guys who he cared very much about the security of the United States. He cared very much about the alliance with Israel. And he was the last, I think, of a style of Democrat, substantial style, that we really miss now. And I think the fact that there's so few Joe Liebermans out there has driven not just the Democrats, but, you know, both sides to the point where they can't, they not only can't negotiate on things, but they can't even recognize things that are really important. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, up until the Obama years, it seemed to me, and I don't want to blame Obama specifically for this, although I think he has a lot to do with it, but there was common ground that there, that the government's most important job was to keep the country safe. And we lost that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you get that back without something terrible happening.
Yeah. So let's get into it in earnest and first go to New York City and not the Trump legal stuff, but this terrible shooting of a cop, a traffic stop, happened to be two career criminals in this car, bunch of priors. I think one guy 21, the other 14. And this Officer Diller is shot in the gut, and just a terrible tragedy. And he, to the end, you know, was all about duty, was grappling with the suspect, was trying to keep the gun, which had fallen on the ground, away from him, at least according to the reports I have seen. And just goes to how these traffic stops are no joke. You know, you often see on Twitter, someone's outraged, oh, this cop shouted at someone during a traffic stop or seemed on edge. Well, there's a reason, because they're you know, approaching the car in a vulnerable position, not knowing who's inside or what might happen. And sometimes the worst does, and it did here.
Yeah, and what everybody says about Officer Diller is that he had very good street instincts. And that was always my experience. When I was a prosecutor, we worked with New York City cops on a lot of task forces, violent crime task forces and drug task forces. And, you know, the FBI guys are great. They have their strengths, DEA guys as well. But there was nothing like New York City cops for just flat out street smarts. Mm-hmm. And they just, people used to poke a little fun in the defense lawyer community when we'd have these suppression hearings, and the Supreme Court jurisprudence on when you can make a stop on the street. I think it was Chief Justice Rehnquist always reminded people that it was the totality, whether you had enough suspicion was a question of the totality of the circumstances. But he would always say the totality of the circumstances as observed by a trained police officer. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, there's a big difference between what the normal person sees on the street and what the cop sees on the street. And in this instance, Officer Diller, obviously, is about 6 o'clock in Far Rockaway on Monday, and he didn't like what he saw. You know, like, is a car parked in a weird way, illegally, in front of a bus stop. And they approach the car, and there's these two guys in there, and they look like they're up to something. And he tells them to roll down the window. No response. He tells Rivera, the guy with the 21 priors who's on the passenger side, to move his hands so he can see them. And then, of course, Rivera opens fire on him. And it does turn out the police now suspect that these two guys were either casing a place or they were casing a person. They're obviously career criminals. And the big scandal is, what the hell are they doing mm-hmm. on the street? And it's the answer, of course, to that is New York's laws now, about which relate to not just making it difficult to get somebody in custody in the first place, but to keep people who should be in custody, career committed criminals. Who are recidivist offenders, and they don't want to keep them in custody. These crazy policies.
These guys had gone to jail, though, right?
Yes, multiple times. Mm-hmm. In fact, when they finally searched these guys, one of the reasons they think they were up to something that wasn't going to be good was not only the way that they were parked and the way they acted when the cops came, but then, you know, when they searched them, it turns out that this guy Rivera, who shot and killed Officer Diller, has a shiv hidden in his butt. And the other guy has a gun elsewhere in the car. So, and that's besides the gun that was used by Rivera to kill Officer Diller. So clearly these guys were up to something, and they're guys who should be in prison. They have like the 30, you mentioned 35 priors. A lot of them are violent crimes. As I understand it, this guy, the driver whose name was Lindy Jones, who's 41, he's got 14 priors. His nickname is Killa. That's how he's known on the street. So, you know, I think there's great anger, obviously, in the law enforcement community. This was this was really unprovoked. The only rational explanation is that these police officers rightly suspected that something bad was going on, and they stopped it before it happened, because otherwise this response by these guys doesn't make any sense. There's a lot of anger among the police because they have to deal day in and day out with guys that they end up arresting multiple times, and they know that these guys don't belong. I mean, they belong locked up. You know, that's just it. There's bad people who belong locked up. A very small percentage of the population that commits a very large percentage of the crime.
Yeah. So it's such a depressing time for cops generally, and for New York City cops. My wife is friends with a woman who's from Ukraine, and her husband is also from Ukraine. You know, American dream type story, law-abiding people, you know, good people, working class jobs. You know, she's a nurse and her husband is a cop, but we were visiting them last summer, and he was going off on, you know, had to leave to go do a 12-hour shift or whatever it is. And they were talking about what it's like. And it's just, they want to do everything right. They want to abide by every rule. And then he's going to go and watch people drink in public, you know, and smoke pot in public. And he can't fight back if they attack him. And, you know, it could ruin his life on any given, you know, besides just the physical danger, which we're talking about with Diller, you know, he could become infamous, right? Because he fights with a guy the wrong way, right? Or whatever it is. And so they're considering, you know, should I even stay in for 20 years, which used to be kind of the benchmark. You'd stay for 20 years to get your retirement. And a lot of them are just, why would I bother? This is too risky and dangerous. So they feel beleaguered, you know, and a good working society, you want the criminals to feel beleaguered, not the people who are supposed to be protecting us from the criminals. Yeah,
it's true. Every aspect of their life is more difficult. They're understaffed for precisely the reason that you just described. And there are burdens that get imposed on them that people don't appreciate. Like, for example, I've spent a lot of time in Chicago over the last few months. We have a precinct fairly close to where we are here. That in the springtime, and now it'll go forward until the autumn, is where the police stations and the airports are where they basically are parking a number of the migrants who are here, because they can't figure out what to do with them. So what do? They put them at they put them in the police station. So you have like a tent city in front, and they have to, you know, like make sure that they're that it's reasonable for them to stay in the area and have facilities in the area and be able to, you know, eat and the like. So they don't eat. It's not even like they go back to the station and, you know, can take a breather between operations. It's like they really are literally on duty all the time, and the responsibilities that they have, there's a broader array of them, I think, than we appreciate. It's a very high tension job, and police agencies, municipal police departments in America's biggest cities are all down hundreds of police because they've made it such a difficult thing to do, and because they feel like the political leadership of these cities isn't behind them.
Yeah.
You know, that there's a big to-do about the wake and funeral of Officer Diller. The reporting in New York is they're telling these politicians who've put in all these laws about defunding the police and other provisions that just make their lives completely miserable and return us to the 70s where, you know, the cops are doing the paperwork for hours while the guy that they just arrested is already back on the street again. So you wonder, why do you make an arrest in the first place if the system's not going to mm-hmm. back you up? So they don't, you know, the law enforcement community obviously is red hot angry now, and they don't want these politicians around. And, you know, I mean, it's going to be a terrible, it already is a terrible few days in New York. But the politics of this is white hot right now.
All right. So let's get to Trump stuff. The civil fraud case, which we've talked about a lot, and the bond he had to post, he got it reduced to 175. And at the same time, this miracle Truth Social merger has come through. So at least in theory, it's raining money in Trump world. So why did he get the reduction in that, in the bond?
Well, I think, you know, the bond is still very high, like $175 million, right. Lot of money. And I think, Rich, that the math on this, it's not quite perfect, but, you know, I've heard a number of people say that, you know, the $454 million bond was reduced to $175. It wasn't $454 million. That's the size of the judgment. But as we've discussed, the judgment goes up by about $1 million every 9 days or so.
Yeah.
Because the interest started out as over $112,000 a day. I think it's now over $114,000 a day because the interest compounds, yeah. Right? The bigger the
compound interest, yeah.
Yeah. So the bigger the judgment gets, the more the daily interest payment is. So he would actually have had to get a bond of about $550 million or more. So I think what the appellate court basically did was slash it by 2/3. Now, the big question then becomes, you know, why did they do that? And it invites the inquiry, are they looking at the merits of the case? Like, have they looked at this enough that they already realized that what Judge Engoron did here was completely off the reservation? And that Tish James's use of this statute in this context was wrong. I would be very surprised if the court had dug into the merits of this so far. I think very simply here, the issue is that there's all kinds, when you're dealing with a big business that's successful, and the Trump business seems to be successful over time, there's all kinds of holdings that big businesses have. And every business is different. Trump's business is real estate. And a lot of it, and a lot of the most expensive real estate, and the most, you know, the real estate that would be most sellable, it's in New York. And, you know, if Trump's fortune was in bags of money, then, you know, you'd have to worry about that. You can put bags of money on a plane and fly them someplace, but buildings aren't going anywhere, right? They're going to be here. Mm-hmm. So the claim that Tish James makes that she needed a bond to be secure under circumstances where he has a lot of assets in New York that, as a practical matter, he can't move, and his business, even though the appellate court has lifted some of the restrictions in the judgment pending appeal about whether he can continue to do business, about whether he can continue to get loans and the like, what they've left in place is the monitor. So the business is under monitoring. There's conditions that if they want to move any of their assets, they have to get let the monitor object if they want to do anything like that. And the property's not going anyplace. So she's not really, Tish James, in a good position to say, well, if I prevail on appeal, but that doesn't happen for 2 years, how do I know I'm still going to have property to execute against to collect the judgment? You know, he's got plenty of property. It'll be there. It's not going anyplace, and he's not going to be able to do much with it. So I think they realized that under those circumstances, a bond of that size was just ridiculous. You know, it was just unnecessary. And if you're an appellate court, you should be offended by that idea, because given that this was such a hyper-political exercise, this lawsuit, one of the things I think you really have to worry about is, did Engoron and James try to get this judgment to be so high that as a practical matter, Trump wouldn't be able to get the expected bond and therefore wouldn't be able to challenge it on appeal? As a practical matter, In other words, was the bond set at this ridiculous level in order to frustrate his right to appeal? And if you're an appellate court, and that question is not an idle question, it may actually be a colorable one in this circumstance, I think you want to make sure that you take action that doesn't suggest that you're flushing the case against Trump. You know, they may still think it's a very serious case, but you also don't want his right to appeal to be frustrated. And I think if they have any concern at all, I mean, not that this should be the first concern in a court's mind, but if they have any concern at all about the business climate in New York and the fear of these big companies, which is very real, that if they can do this to Trump, that they could do it to any big business that either is one that the left doesn't like in the first place or that makes itself hostile to the governing regime, you know, a lot of those businesses are going to up and leave. If you don't need to be in New York and it's an environment like this, you're going to leave New York. So I think it was kind of on the appellate division to try to reset things so that the business community understands that this is a real court system. And I think they wanted to signal that Trump is going to get a fair shake on appeal. That doesn't mean he's going to win, as we've talked about before. I'd be surprised if he gets a clean sweep on appeal, but I think it's going to be a real appeal.
Yeah. So what about this Truth Social deal? How useful is that to him in this fix?
I think this is just the funniest thing, I have to say. I heard J-Pod on the commentary podcast, John Podhoretz, call it deus ex machina, which I think is a good way of putting it. But, you know, it's like you can understand why Trump pushes everything to extremes, because he feels like something's always going to happen to get him out of a tight spot.
Yeah, it seems to, right?
I mean, every time they think we got him now, he like, you know, Truth Social hits the jackpot. Yeah. It's unbelievable. So
assumes he's going to get out of everything. I mean, that's his. I was with him over the summer, and that's basically what he says. It's just, he called himself a fatalist. I just figure, you know, and what he means is it's just going to work out. And if it doesn't work out, I'll figure another way to make it work out, you know?
Because it's never fatal. He's the fatalist who never gets the fatality. Yeah. It's unbelievable. But you know, I wonder how real this is and how long it's going to last. I mean, you know, look, Truth Social, which is now trading under his initials, DJT, that's the merged company with the Trump Media and Technology Group, merged with the SPAC, and they now are, I think they're trading under the ticker DJT. And his supporters, I think in a weird way, this is a way of like, MAGA supporting Trump. These are not like, I would be very surprised if a lot of these people who are buying and bidding up this stock are, you know, people who are normally in the market and playing the market. I think a lot of Trump supporters are bidding this up as a way to express support. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it's at least in the short term, it's acting like a meme stock, you know, one of those things that we saw in the last few years where like irrationally they bid up. What was the movie out? Was it AMC? Yeah. Was one of the first ones where they just like, you know, they bid it out of the stratosphere. But yeah, I'm one of these people. Well, I guess I'm like a David Bonson disciple. And I think like the thing that matters with companies is value and, you know, how much, what are they going to produce over time? And I'm not seeing a lot of value there. I mean, I don't pretend to be.
I mean, what we're talking about is Trump's posts, basically. I mean, does anyone look at anything else on Truth Social?
Yeah, and not only that, Rich, he had, I want to say, like 80 million followers on Twitter. And what's he got on Truth Social? 6 million, something like that. I mean, it's small. And they've burnt through. Part of the reason that this merger took so long, I mean, this merger could have happened 2 years ago, but they've burnt through a lot of their startup capital. I think they've only ever generated like $3 million. Now, you know, didn't I want to say like Amazon ran at a loss for 7 years before it hit the jackpot and
it became doing it really deliberately, is my understanding. I'm not the business guy, but
they could have
nonprofits, but they didn't want to because they wanted to keep expanding.
Yeah, but I think even like people like David, who understands this stuff in a way that you and I don't get, I think they would tell you that you could tell Amazon was coming, even if it was running at a loss, because it was getting everything together to really take off. I'm not getting, maybe it's there and I just don't get it, and maybe it's got opportunities that I'm not seeing.
Well, you're a business and finance guy now, Andy, so I don't think so.
I'm telling you, I need the Capital Matters transfer, Chief. But you know, they've burned through a lot of money and they haven't generated much in the way of profit. Doesn't mean, I guess, they can't eventually become very profitable. But it just seems to me to value this at, what's it now, value with the stock? Like $7 billion? What was it? It was trading at like, it was 37 last week and it's like 67 today. But like the first day it was up to 79 at one point, and then it closed to 59.
I never get in the ground level of these things, Andy.
Yeah, well, if you were Trump, you'd be in on the ground level, because he's going to want to get while the getting is good.
Yeah.
And the thing is, so he owns 60%, because as you point out, he is Truth Social. I mean, there really isn't much else. So he owns, I think, about 60% of it, maybe a little more than that. So if it's worth at this moment $7 billion, do the math. He's worth, you know, it's about $4 billion. Dollars for him. But at the moment, his stock is locked. Now, to get it unlocked, meaning he can actually get it and sell it, or at least be allowed to borrow against some or all of it, which he may need to do, he needs to get the permission of the board. But he dominates the board. So the board includes, there's seven members of the board, and five of them are Don Trump Jr., Devin Nunes, who he, you know, basically got out of Congress to run this thing, this Truth Social thing, or the Trump Media Company that is the parent of Truth Social, Kash Patel, who's a major Trump aide, and then two other people who were in his government, Robert Lighthizer, who was the U.S. Trade Representative under Trump, and Linda McMahon, who was his Small Business Association's chief. So that's five of the seven board members. I think the other two board members may be connected to the SPAC. But, you know, he's got enough people on the board who are his people that he could pretty much, I would think, do what he wants to do. On the other hand, if it starts to look like he's going to cash out, this thing is going to crash and nothing flat. Mm-hmm. So if they really want to make this a growing concern rather than have – you know, Democrats from now until November say it's a pump and dump scheme, which is what they'll otherwise say. You know, they got to be very careful how they handle that. If this gets perceived like he's cashing out, then the thing will crash. And what looks like a deus ex machina will be a debacle. But they just need to be careful how they handle it.
Yeah. So speaking of Trump and his fatalism and always escaping, and David Bahnsen, David wrote a wonderful piece last year, I think it was, about Trump and the Plaza Hotel, and how like no mortal would ever be able to like buy the Plaza, and then it goes bankrupt, and then just come out without breaking a sweat the way Trump did.
He's amazing.
So we also have the Alvin Bragg case. We now have a trial date, and we have a gag order. What do we need to know here?
Well, I couldn't give the thing that. That prompted the gag order justice. So I have given you the post from Truth Social, which may be, I figured this out this morning, that the post that Trump did at Truth Social may be the first post for the new company. And maybe that's the reason the stock went through the roof.
It ends in all caps. So it's a good post.
So on Monday, the same day that the Court of Appeals You need to be careful about this stupid New York nomenclature. The case is now in front of the Appellate Division, First Department. I don't want to say Court of Appeals because in New York, the Court of Appeals is the highest court and the case isn't there yet. So the Appellate Division, the same day that it slashed the bond to $175 million. And by the way, Trump has 10 days to make that. And he says he's going to make it in cash or bonds and securities and the like. So we'll watch that. But by the end of next week, he should pull that together. So on the same day, there was a hearing in Manhattan Criminal Court, which Trump attended, before Judge Juan Merchan in the Bragg case, the hush money criminal case, where Trump was trying to get the trial either get the case dismissed or have the trial postponed for another 3 months over this discovery dispute that we've discussed, where he got like 100,000 plus documents from the Southern District of New York that was dumped on him. It wasn't really dumped on him. He subpoenaed them, so it's not like he wasn't asking for it. You know, it's important to sort of, because there's a lot of misinformation about that out there in commentary land. When, you know, it's become a sort of a thing for the Trump people to say he got over 100,000 documents dumped on him. And the implication is that Bragg dumped them on him. And that's not what happened. These are documents that Bragg says he tried to get but couldn't get from the Southern District of New York, and that Trump subpoenaed directly from the Southern District of New York. My old office is the Justice Department in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. They gave the documents to Trump, even though they evidently told Bragg a year ago that they wouldn't give him the documents. So that's where the documents come from. It's not from the prosecutor who's prosecuting him. It's from the federal government. So when Trump is running around saying, you know, they just dumped 100,000 documents on me, Bragg didn't do that. And Trump asked for the documents. So it's a little bit more complicated than the commentary lets on. But in any event, Bragg pushed back that very few of the documents were relevant. I think he concedes that about 300 of the documents are relevant, but most of it, he says, is either duplicative of stuff that the state already gave Trump, or else it's, as far as they're concerned, it's inculpatory because it has to do with statements that were made by Michael Cohen, who the Southern District was prosecuting. And Michael Cohen's prior versions of events were that Trump was involved in a complicit way in what Bragg regards as a criminal hush money arrangement. So the reason I make the distinction of inculpatory is the prosecutor's obligation is to turn over exculpatory information, or at least make the defendant aware if the prosecutor knows of information that's exculpatory, information that might suggest that the person is not guilty of the charges. But if you're the prosecutor and you know that somebody else has information that is not in your possession and it's inculpatory information, that is incriminating information, stuff that would show the defendant is guilty, you don't have any obligation to obtain that information or tell the defendant about it. You only need to your obligation is with respect to exculpatory information that's not in your possession, but that you know of. So Bragg basically poo-pooed this whole thing. And I think the problem for Trump's lawyers was Judge Merchan asked them, well, how many of these documents are relevant? And rather than, you know, giving him a straight answer on that, they said, look, we just got these. It could be thousands and thousands are relevant because we have a much different view of this case than the state does. And Merchan kept asking him, well, you know, give me some examples. And they just basically said, Judge, are you kidding me? They just gave us 100,000 documents a couple of weeks ago. Do you think we've gotten through all this yet? And in the meantime, Bragg's like, we've gotten through everything and there's 300 documents that are relevant. So, you know, you're behind the eight ball with the judge if you can't answer those kind of basic questions. They were hoping that just the sheer number of new materials was going to do the trick for them, and obviously it wasn't. So what Judge Merchan decided was that he would deny the motion for either a dismissal of the case or a lengthy extension. He decided that the discovery violation was not really a violation because it wasn't Bragg's fault. And he said that 3 weeks, the three additional weeks that he has given them beyond the originally scheduled March 25th trial date is more than enough time to go through these documents and sort out what's relevant. And therefore, the trial is going to begin with jury selection on April 15th, which is just a little over 2 weeks from now, basically 2 weeks from Monday. So Trump is obviously very unhappy about that. In the press conference, we should sort this out, Rich. In the press conference that Trump did after the hearing, he was saying that he didn't think there would be an April 15th trial because they were going to appeal Judge Merchan's setting of an April 15th trial date under circumstances where there was this massive discovery violation. And as we've discussed in the context of immunity, there's very few things in the law, in the criminal law, that you get to appeal prior to trial. Immunity happens to be one of them. The judge setting a trial date is not something that you can appeal prior to trial. So I don't, you know, maybe his lawyers haven't explained that to him and he doesn't grasp that. The other thing is, if I were Trump's lawyers, not that Trump listens to his lawyers, but if I were his lawyers, I'd be a little careful here because I think one of his best arguments on appeal is the statute of limitations. And, you know, if I'm right about the statute of limitations, then this should have been a business records misdemeanor and the statute ran in 2019. And if a court sees it that way, then he's going to prevail on appeal. But usually the argument you're making when you're stressing the statute of limitations is that the prosecutors have intentionally delayed in a strategic way in order to undermine your fair trial rights. It's very hard to make that argument if you're saying, give us a 90-day delay. Mm-hmm. You know, because your argument when you're saying that your statute of limitations rights were violated, you're accusing them of delay and you're saying you've been prejudiced by the delay. If you're prejudiced by the delay, you know, any court's going to ask, well, then why are you asking for more delay if it's so prejudicial? Mm-hmm. So I just think, you know, they probably want to soft pedal this. Trump doesn't know soft pedal, right? He's like, you know, whatever happens, he's pedal to the metal on every issue. But I just think, you know, they're not going to get a reversal because of a discovery violation. It's just not happening. You never get a reversal for that. So I wouldn't go too crazy. You know, they've made their point about the discovery. I think they better just get ready for trial.
Mm-hmm. And what do you make of the gag order?
Well, so, I mean, I guess I'm of two minds, as I often am with these issues, about the gag order. There's no way that Trump couldn't have thought that he was going to get a gag order. I mean, this post that he did right after, he did this the morning after this hearing in front of Judge Merchan. I can't help read it and laugh because Trump lights into Judge Merchan, but before he does, he has to pause and say, Judge Juan Merchan, a very distinguished looking man. And I'm like, you know, and then he just like rips him, you know, from limb to limb. Yeah. But yeah. You know, he has to pause and say he's a very distinguished looking man. But, you know, it was a mixed bag. He attacks the judge as, you know, he suffers from a serious case of Trump derangement syndrome. He's a Trump hater, a certified Trump hater, by the way. And then he goes into, you know, I mean, you want to get the judge's hackles up. It's one thing. If you're a judge in a Trump case, you expect to get it, right? But then he goes after the judge's daughter. Right. So he says, that, you know, the daughter's a Democratic operative. And he sort of lays a bunch of this stuff out. And then he says a bunch of stuff about Weisselberg. This is the Trump CFO who Bragg has been trying to squeeze for cooperation for years and who was convicted in a case that Merchan presided over, a tax case where he pled guilty. So he says this is like so classic Trump. He says a bunch of stuff about Weisselberg, where the overarching part of it that Bragg is putting pressure on Weisselberg to flip on Trump is true, but almost every particular thing he says is false. I mean, everything, like he says, the judge treated him very viciously, telling him either you cooperate or I'm putting you in jail for 15 years. Now, I wouldn't be shocked if it turned out that Bragg's prosecutors may have said something along those lines to Weisselberg, but even that would be a reach. But there's no reason to think that Judge Merchan did that. And in fact, Weisselberg pled guilty in a plea agreement over which Merchan presided. He didn't get 15 years, he got 4 months. And he was not required by the state to give any testimony against Trump. He did testify against the Trump Organization, which is why I think it's really insidious of Bragg to have then put him in Rikers Island. A 76-year-old guy puts in Rikers Island. This is the prosecutor who won't put anyone in jail. He puts a 76-year-old guy in jail for 4 months at Rikers Island because he's trying to get him to flip on Trump. But this is even after the guy gave testimony that enabled Bragg to convict Trump's organization on tax charges. Usually the prosecutor wants to reward the cooperation, but they not only did they continue to squeeze Weisselberg, he's just indicted Weisselberg again for perjury. And Trump throws that into the mix in this post as well. But the thing is, Merchan doesn't have anything to do with that case. That's in front of another judge. So he's, in the context of talking about Merchan, he says, they threatened him again with 15 years if he doesn't say something bad about Trump, which Trump, end in quotes, right? So, country destroying scoundrels and thugs have no case against me. Witch hunt. So, look, when a case is close to trial and you're about to pick a jury, judges always clamp down on what people are allowed to say. If it's the kind of case where you're getting people, where the media is covering it, the judge always tells everyone to rein it in when it's getting close to jury selection. That's common sense. And we're within 3 weeks of trial when this happens. So, Trump has to know, number one, given the imminence of the trial, and number two, if you attack the judge and you attack the judge's daughter and you think that that's going to be, that kind of stuff happens. No, that doesn't happen. Judges don't like that. So to my mind, I think Trump is, on this kind of stuff, I think Trump is crazy like a fox. I think he has realized, especially looking at Judge Merchan's rulings, where he basically down the line back Bragg on every one of Trump's challenges to try to get the indictment thrown out in this very, very dodgy case. I think Trump realizes he's likely to get convicted. So he's doing what you do when you're running for president, as he is, when your main argument in the campaign is that your opposition has weaponized the justice system against you. Realizing that the handwriting's on the wall, that there's a good chance he'll get convicted, maybe on every charge in this case. It would make a lot more sense if you convict him. It makes a lot more sense to convict him of 34 counts than one. So I think he sees the handwriting on the wall, and he's starting to set the table to argue that this whole thing was corrupt from the judge and the prosecutor on down. And he's provoking the judge, and he got the kind of reaction that you get when you provoke the judge. So he's been told now he can't talk about the prosecutor's staff, which includes the guy who used to be at the Biden Justice Department who's running the case. He's not supposed to be able to talk about him, which seems ridiculous to me. He's not supposed to talk about the judge's staff. He can still make comments about the judge and about Bragg. And worse, though, Rich, he's not allowed to talk about witnesses. And I think that's just outrageous, because this week the media hyped a documentary that came out about Stormy Daniels, mm-hmm. where she talks about Trump at length. And then I know I wouldn't watch this myself. I'd rather get a root canal. But I see that Michael Cohen has a YouTube show. And it's on like every couple of days. And every episode is talking about Trump. So we have a situation where the guy who's running for president has been gagged about a case that every other person in politics can talk about, including Biden. And Trump is gagged also talking about the witnesses when the witnesses are out there talking about Trump. Mm-hmm. So I think that's crazy. I think that these courts haven't felt like they needed to make any accommodation of the constitutional importance to the public of having robust public discussion in a campaign. They're basically tuning out the campaign like it doesn't exist and say the administration of justice is the main thing here. The reason the administration of justice is an issue is because these prosecutors timed these cases to happen during the campaign. So it's not like Trump's fault that this happened. So I understand the administration of justice and orders like Judge Merchan put in this week or issued this week are pretty normal. But this isn't a normal situation. And I just think constitutionally it's kind of outrageous. And if it were me and I had a choice about it, I would be inclined to say, you know, look, we have laws on the books. If Trump commits incitement, you can arrest him. If he says something that violates the law, you can arrest him. If he defames someone, as E. Jean Carroll has shown, he can be sued. And the other thing is everything he says, if I'm the prosecutor, I loved it when my defendants were yapping in public. The stuff that he's saying now, if he testifies in the trial and they have good prosecutors in this case who know how to do cross-examination, they're going to stick some of this stuff where the sun don't shine. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be very sorry, you know, he ran off with the mouth, except I think he thinks he's already getting convicted anyway. So this has become political combat for him more than a legal strategy.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
So last thing, Andy, I wrote speaking of the weaponization, the legal part of the legal system, I wrote a kind of a trolley column. Well, given everything that's happened here, why wouldn't, if Trump's elected, why wouldn't he just have his Justice Department take the Hur report, subtract the judgment, which is questionable, that you know this shouldn't go in front of a jury because, in part, because Joe Biden is such a forgetful man, and it's going to be hard to convince him that he had the intent, and just use it to charge him, and maybe you don't convict him, maybe you don't ultimately get to trial, but you humiliate him, you drag him through the mud, you make him spend a lot of money, you let your political supporters take delight in this whole process. Why would that not, you know, apply to, it's what's being done to Trump. Why wouldn't Trump just turn around and do it to Biden? And it seems like the other side has given up all the arguments where you would say, no, this shouldn't happen. You know, we have a norm against indicting former presidents. No, we don't, not anymore. You know, it's an ambiguous case. Well, a lot of these cases against Trump are ambiguous. You know, a prosecutor declined to take it up, so that means it should never be taken up. Well, that's not how Bragg operated, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I really don't see the logical argument against what you laid out. I think, you know, in point of fact, part of what makes MAGA, I mean, there's a lot of things that make MAGA and its agenda part company with conservatives in important ways. But part of what makes MAGA MAGA and have a critique of what they call conservative ink or whatever it's known as at the moment is that you have to fight fire with fire. You know, we're on the traditional conservative side. You know, I'm always taking the view that I want to beat them. I don't want to be them. And the mm-hmm. MAGA philosophy is, you know, that's for chumps, right? That you have to fight like they fight, and you have to be willing to get in the mud and do what they do. And that's the only way that you'll ever stop them. So it would be totally consistent with that philosophy. I also think that any chance of talking Trump out of that probably ends with jury selection in the Bragg case, if it hasn't ended already, because they are now doing it. I mean, this is going to get real in a way. I mean, you thought the civil case was real, and I'm the one who said for a year, don't go to sleep on the civil case. But this is about to get really real when there's jury selection. He has to be there every day. He's got to sit in that courtroom while people testify against him. He's got to sit down and shut up when the judge tells him to sit down and shut up, if it comes to that. And he could get convicted. And even though it's a ridiculous, overcharged case, theoretically, because of the statutes involved, he's looking at, I think, 136 years in prison for like a misdemeanor, nonviolent business records case that nobody should do an hour in prison for. Somebody said to me on television the other day, I actually had one of these moments, like I didn't know exactly how to answer. Somebody said to me, do you really think he's going to get sent to jail over this? And I started to say, nobody should get sent to jail over this. It's too ridiculous. But then I thought, nobody should get a $454 million judgment in a fraud case with no fraud victims. Mm-hmm. So how do I know they're not going to send him to jail? Why are they doing the case? Why did they indict it this way if Bragg isn't going to push for prison time? So I think Trump's inclination, if he wins the election and the Justice Department is answers to him, he's going to push for, at the very least, aggressive investigations of the people who were behind this stuff. And even if charges don't follow, investigations are ruinous. I mean, they're humiliating. They're very expensive. And even if you don't get charged at the end of the rainbow, there's a lot of anxiety and expense that's attached to that. And if you do get charged, if Biden got charged in that case, in most cases, Rich, you know, I know we talked about this, and it's made crystal clear in your column. If a defendant does all the acts that are necessary, all the essential element actus reus stuff, the acts that are necessary to commit a crime, and what you're down to is intent, generally speaking, those cases go to trial. I mean, those cases get charged. And, you know, if there's evidence in both directions, that's the kind of case where you say, let the jury sort out intent. But here, the case is even worse for Biden because the prosecutor makes a finding in his report that Biden acted willfully. And the statute doesn't even require you to prove that, right? We've talked about that you could win a case in that statute as a prosecutor with gross negligence. And they have Biden out of his own mouth in a recorded statement saying to the ghostwriter, I found the classified information down in the basement. Yeah. You know, so I mean, you know, you don't usually get evidence like that out of the guy's own mouth. So this is the kind of case that it's kind of highly unusual that it didn't get charged. I mean, it didn't get charged because, as you point out in your column, you know, for that fleeting moment, we pretended like we still have norms against this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
But if they're out the window, I could absolutely see Trump saying he wants, as he's put, what did he say? Not vengeance. I can't, retribution. He's going to be the retribution, and maybe he will.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks everyone for listening and have a great Easter. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.